everybody. Welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the movie review podcast where I stop talking briefly and then I put in a sound effect, probably something I already had in the library.
Thank you, Rodney.
Ah, that takes me back.
Nicely done. I did something I love doing today that I don't get to do too often, and that is go record shopping.
Ooh. Did you go to Record Surplus?
Record Surplus is our local record joint.
It's on Santa Monica Boulevard, right?
Santa Monica and Centinela here in West LA. And they used to be on Pico, and they moved.
I know. It used to be within walking distance. It was so great.
Yeah.
There was a video game called Brutal Legend, which took place inside, like, the world of heavy metal album covers, and Jack Black played the protagonist, and the beginning of the video game was Jack Black walking into Record Surplus to buy heavy metal albums.
Specifically Record Surplus.
So I'm watching, I'm playing this video game for the first time, and I'm like, that's two blocks away, Jack Black is there now! So great. I missed that story at that location in particular. That was a great location.
Yeah, the old location they had, the dollar bin, was an entire, like, little attic loft. You had to climb up a staircase to get to it. And when they moved locations, it was one floor, but they still call that area the attic. It's just off to the side in this big warehouse space.
Tradition.
I bring it up because I was able to procure, for only $6, six separate volumes of special effects.
Ooh.
Like audio effects.
That's cool.
You can get, like, audio special effects in the public domain for real, real cheap there.
Oh, can I borrow that?
maybe so, but that's another way of announcing, hey, I finally get to write again, so there's another radio drama on the distant horizon.
Yes, that's
so
awesome!
I'm going to try to make another one.
That's cool. Witty has written and directed and produced and edited several radio dramas already. If you want to buy them, you can contact him directly, or they are available at no additional charge for our top tier patrons over
there. That's
Patreon.
Right. Yeah.
Critically Network.
If you're one of the Alien Prince, that's the name of our top tier.
Yeah. So if you've recently signed up and you didn't know because it's been a hot minute, be sure to like reach out to Whitney. He'll send them over. But
For sure.
But in any case, this is our movie review show. My name is William Bibbiani. Everyone calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I am a film critic.
You sure are.
Indeed.
And this week on Critically Acclaimed, we're reviewing the new releases Candyman, which is the new one.
Candyman 4.
Yeah. He's All That, the new one. Vacation Friends, the old one. And
it's a new film.
But it's the only one, right?
It's the only film called Vacation Friends, as far as I know.
So it's also the old one.
All right.
And No Man of God. Mm. I have no idea if there are other films called that. Anyway, those are the new movies we're reviewing this week on Critically Acclaimed. That's an interesting crop of cinema, isn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting.
Just a big old bunch of everything in there.
Let's start a conversation with Candyman, because this is a film that has been delayed, and in fact, if it had come out on its original release date, it would have felt a hell of a lot more timely. Because I think its original release date was right around the time the Black Lives Matter protests were happening.
I think it's always going to be timely, but it would have been like really on the nose.
Rather, unfortunately, it's always going to be timely.
Yeah, very true.
Candyman, the original film was from 1992. It's based on a mid-80s short story by Clive Barker. The original story took place in England. The film, directed by a British director,
Bernard Rose,
was transposed to the Cabrini-Green projects in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And that film is about Virginia Madsen, a young white woman who goes into the projects to examine the urban legends therein and discovers the legend of the Candyman. And as it turns out, the Candyman is this real malevolent spirit. And as the ghost of, we get to learn his origin story over the course of the sequels.
Yeah.
He was
wronged by a white mob. He was horrifically tortured, killed, and now his legacy is that if you look in a mirror and say the words Candyman 5 times in a row, I don't recommend it. Why risk it? He becomes real and kills you. The original Candyman is one of the best horror movies of the 90s, and I don't care what anyone says, the 90s was a great decade for horror movies, so if you ask me, that puts it on the list of the best horror movies ever made. incredibly well acted, smartly written, the score by Philip Glass is just eerie.
Which they play over the credits of this mm-hmm. new fourth Candyman film.
But it's also really thoughtful, and it's very much about the legacy of racism and the way that that legacy becomes distorted through the act of ongoing storytelling. And over the course of that first film, here is a white grad student who is trying to take this story of black trauma, black pain, and basically just explain it away.
Well, kind of
rob it of its power, and then of course it comes to life and regains that power.
What she's trying to do is intellectualize it. And the first Candyman film is actually incredibly intelligent about the way it wields the language and the use of the intelligentsia of white academia to intellectualize and distance themselves from black pain and how it
also black fiction as we can explain it away.
It's using this sort of racist trope that it has to be written by a white grad student in order to be like legitimized in this weird way.
And then the movie literally attacks her for it.
And it takes her to task for it. And I think it's very telling that in this new Candyman film, when we are retold the Candyman story, it's about her. She did co-opt that.
Whether she meant to or not, she became the tale, and that's what a lot of people know about it now. Boy, I'm glad you picked up on that too, because I thought that was really clever.
There's a lot to pick up on it in this new Candyman. It's directed by Nia DaCosta, an incredibly assured director. She is just knocking it out of the park. Yeah. Like visually, there's a lot of really interesting.
Did you see her debut, Little Woods? Because I really need to go back and check this out. This is the first film
of hers that I've seen, and she's really, really doing it. She co-wrote the screenplay with Jordan Peele and
Wynn Rosenfeld.
Yeah. And Jordan Peele also made a film called Us, which is an incredibly busy film that's full of a lot of interesting ideas. And I can see Nia DaCosta. She's probably the one who's kind of like
making
a little bit more of a movie out of it, because I can see a lot of ideas just sneezed all over this movie that don't connect in any kind of meaningful way.
I think the worst
just
thing,
like Us.
I think the very worst thing I can say about this new Candyman, which I admire, is that it's a little messy in the middle. It's trying to be like three different kinds of movies all at once. It's trying to be a movie about an artist who might be losing their mind. It's trying to be a conventional slasher in a lot of ways. It's trying to be something that's actually about like history and art as a concept. And it's all kind of a little slapdash in the middle. I think it comes together well at the end, but it's really slapdash in the middle.
A lot of its symbolism is really, really great. Although it's a little... Candyman, we learn, there's a line of dialogue where Candyman is not the bee, Candyman is the whole hive.
Yeah.
And how Candyman is less this one vengeful spirit and more an ever-changing spirit, very much like Freddy Krueger in New Nightmare.
Mm.
This changing form of evil that has come to represent the stain left by violence against black bodies.
Yeah.
And how that can take many different forms. And unfortunately, Candyman is... At once, he's a boogeyman, he's a spirit of vengeance, and he's also something to be feared. He's like all of these different things at the same time.
He's a martyr, and he's a demon, and he's a vigilante in some respects. And other respects,
Joker, a smoker, a midnight toker. He's a little bit of everything.
But that's what stories are, aren't they? They evolve over time, as different people tell them, as different people co-opt the iconography and use it to mean different things in different generations, the meaning shifts. And we've seen this with all the great monsters, I think. Dracula, Frankenstein.
This idea that Candyman, the demon itself, like the monster, is changing as generations pass, is a perfectly fitting way to look at this monster.
I agree.
It also has this entirely separate criticism of the art world and how white criticism affects black art.
Yeah.
I don't know what the comment is here, but the first victim of Candyman in sort of this art installation made by the main character, let me cite the actor's name because he's pretty good. Yahya Abdul-Mateen II.
Oh, yeah.
He puts this art installation, he's inspired by Candyman when he hears the story, and he makes an art installation called Say My Name, and after hours, there's a character who's...
He owns the gallery.
He owns the gallery, yeah. And he's canoodling with his mistress, and he invokes Candyman, and they kill him, and that guy is named Clive.
And yeah, that was weird, right?
If they're trying to kill Clive Barker, like somehow but nothing else really implicated in all of
nothing
this.
Nothing else really connects with Clive Barker. I feel like what they're trying to say by having a lot of the Candyman's actual murder victims in this movie are white. Not exclusively, which perhaps muddles the intent of the murders a little bit, but a lot of this movie is about, because the protagonist is an artist, because the protagonist is an artist who is well-to-do. He's a black artist who is trying to be, he's inspired by and actually trying to make money. He's thrilled by the idea of success. When a murder happens, he goes, oh my God, they said the name of my art installation on the news. Not, oh my God, that guy is dead.
Yeah.
He's divorced himself from that.
To which his girlfriend is played by Teyonah Parris from Chirac.
Yeah.
See Chirac if you can. That's an excellent movie. Who she's completely disgusted by that.
Exactly.
Course.
So
it's,
like, so
it's
we,
pretty on the nose.
So like, we have a lot of white characters here who are only interested in black art to the extent to which that they can profit off of it. And there's a white critic in this movie who specifically speaks about how, you know, oh yes, you're talking about racism, but it's all a bunch of cliches.
It's
so
like,
who cares?
Yeah, performative cliche.
Exactly.
It's, yeah, doesn't feel honest to me.
Yeah, and here he is trying to say something about gentrification, but it's also gentrification that he's taking part of. He's moved back into
the
decaying corpse of the Cabrini Green now that it's being gentrified, and he himself is going to profit off of the legend of Candyman, which is a long historical series of martyrs, and he pays a price for that too.
Which was actually a big part of Candyman 3, which is
which
is a terrible movie, by the way. It's like really aggressively awful.
It feels like there's a couple. If you've only seen Candyman, good for you. The first Candyman's great. If you've seen Candyman 2, Farewell to the Flesh, or Candyman 3, Day of the Dead, you'll notice that they're not as good. The Farewell to the Flesh has some defenders. I'm not a fan. It's definitely better than Day of the Dead.
Yeah,
but
I
was surprised.
Day of the Dead is trash.
It's
but,
just badly made.
Farewell to the Flesh was a Bill Condon joint, so it has some style and idea to it.
I think it misses the point. But regardless, what I was surprised by watching this new Candyman was that clearly they saw the sequels and tried to rescue a few of the ideas and try to incorporate them in a more thoughtful way. Even the whole art gallery sequence by itself is very familiar to something that happens in Candyman 3. And so I'm watching this, I'm like, oh. And it reminded me a little bit. It reminded me a little bit of Rob Zombie's Halloween 2. A movie which I'm rather fond of, which is, you know, it's another messy film, but Rob Zombie looked at all the Halloween sequels, all of them. And said, here's a bunch of slapdash movies that couldn't figure out how to follow up on Michael Myers. But every single one of them had something neat in it. So I'm going to do one scene that's a siege in a hospital. That's from Halloween 2. I'm going to do the whole thing about maybe his evil isn't going to infect his niece. And I'll incorporate that. Loomis wrote a book. Well, I can use that as a plot point. Why not? So, like, it's just kind of this, like, interesting amalgam of all the good ideas.
Where does Weird Al Yankovic come into all
Halloween 3. I don't know. What do you want from me? I don't have a good answer for that. Halloween 3, done.
Sure. but yeah, I'm not sure if the screenwriters or the producers were trying to incorporate a broader mythology from the Candyman series entire. I don't think it's necessary to see Farewell to the Flesh Day of the Dead
But if you did, I think you might be pleasantly surprised to see that it kind of incorporated somehow.
I've seen them all, and it's still a little bit slapdash. It doesn't fit together perfectly well, just as a like a movie or a story. There's a lot of these plot elements that don't make a whole lot of sense.
It gets really plot heavy in the third act in ways that almost lost me. I was really admiring this movie, even when it wasn't great. It was taking big swings, and then things started to come together in the third act. And I don't want to go into detail here. Things come together in the third act in a way that I thought was frankly kind of crap. I was looking at the plot specifically. Was like, and here's why these things happen, and here's how it all connects, and here's how the movie's going to end.
This character is actually ultimately headed towards.
And I'm thinking to myself, this means very little. It's actually very frustratingly almost trite. And then it doesn't end that way. And the way it actually ends, I feel, recontextualizes everything.
Yeah.
Well, in a way that is very satisfying.
It recontextualizes, like I said, I like the symbolism, and I like all of these ideas, and like this, there's like single pages of various essays all kind of shuffled together into this one. And I do like that about this movie, and I think Nia DaCosta is a skilled enough director that she can make a little bit of thematic sense of all of this, and she also stages some pretty good scare sequences.
Oh yeah,
as
there's
well.
Some good scare.
There's a good scare sequence in a public restroom that I was really fond of, and the best sequence in the movie was a kill scene from the exterior of an apartment as the camera pulls out, and you get like this tiny
that's
little
really,
detail.
That's really great. Yeah,
sea
I love
of
that
windows.
One.
It's like Jacques Tati murder scene.
Yeah,
that one was a really really great sequence. There's a lot in here to recommend, and I do recommend it. I think this is one of those rare instances where I think 91 minutes isn't enough time. There's actually so many ideas in here. I wish they had sort of stayed with a few of them longer so it could like cohere a little bit more strongly.
No, I definitely think there's enough material here that you could have really played with it. I think there's something interesting about this new Candyman in that it is, even compared to the original, which was not subtle in its... Not even subtext, it's text. Yeah. It was very on the nose.
And the original was more subtle than this one.
Oh, you know, I agree. My point is the original was more subtle than this one, but it was still pretty in your face.
Yeah.
And it should have been. It had a point to make.
It's quite upfront.
This new one, there's something frustrating I'm finding where a lot of people are saying that like horror is better when you don't talk about what the horror is about and it's all just subtext. And that can work, but for me, I'm thinking of a couple of things that make this really exciting to me. One is that here's a movie that isn't afraid to just talk about what it's talking about. And it's also a movie that is emerging from, let's be honest here, the world that we're in right now, people who care about things like art and social activism, issues that come up very directly in the movie Candyman, we're not subtle about it. We tweet about it directly. We write essays about it. We talk about it with like-minded people or people who disagree with our points of view. We live, I think, in part because social media has made communication so direct in a lot of ways. We live in a time when people are very openly talking about the issues that interest them and the issues that are important to them constantly. And to say that discourse doesn't belong in cinema is to deny the fact that that's how we talk right now. Not everybody, but a lot of people, and those people deserve to have their voices expressed in cinema.
The discourse trademark I know that's a very vague, broad term, but you know, it's a way to talk about sort of the conversations and the way we tend to have them on social media.
The back and forth
does tend to be a lot more direct. We're getting to the point a lot faster with one another in many, many cases. Having a much more direct film is fine. I've never had any problems with films being direct. We just talked about this very thing when we reviewed Malcolm X on the Streaming Club, or I guess it's critically reclaimed now. We retitled that show. I'm not going to object to anything about sort of it's very openly stated thesis.
The only problem with that is if it becomes boring, but that's true for anything. Any kind of movie can become boring if you're not an interesting enough filmmaker. Candyman is, it's throwing a lot of material in there, and some of it's a little slapdash, like the way it's put together feels a little crammed in, but it's never boring.
Yeah.
I was on high alert this entire movie. I was really just absorbing this whole thing. I really was excited. I think this is exciting filmmaking, even in the little bits here and there where I was just like, okay, that plot I don't really care about that, but this part works so well, I don't mind. Yeah. I'm so fascinated by it, I don't mind that there are little things.
Nitpicks. Nitpicky plot stuff. The ideas are more important than that, and Nia DaCosta tells it in an exciting enough way that you're still going to be swept along even as the plot makes less sense and what happens to the main character doesn't make any sense. There's a lot of interesting visual stuff. I love the way this film was photographed. Did you notice this? If you go back and watch the original Candyman, the opening title sequence is like a helicopter shot over Chicago.
Yeah.
As Philip Glass's really scary score plays. And Nia DaCosta opened this with a camera that's looking straight up from the ground.
Yeah.
As it goes through the
It's eerie, actually. It's a good looking title sequence. Mm. I really liked it a lot. I was going to say something else. Oh, the other thing I was thinking, I was watching this, and I just, I feel like, I'm glad that this movie is, I mean, there's always going to be some people who don't like anything, but I'm glad that this movie is finding some appreciative audience, and I know there are some very well-written criticisms or people who just didn't care for it or didn't care for the way that it dealt with the issue of generational black trauma, and I think, fair enough, there are also people who are really responding to it. Both sides have some validity, I think. But the conversation will continue, and eventually we'll start having more and more complex conversations about this movie as we become able to have spoiler-ridden conversations about this movie. Because I think that once you can really talk about some of like the revelations and the way that the movie actually ends, I think that's when you can really have a serious conversation about everything this movie is laying down. Right now we're being a little vague, and we're doing the best we can, but... I was reminded a lot of a movie, which I don't think it was as skillfully put together, but a movie which is also a lot of good ideas, really interesting dialogue, took some big swings, and I think the ending either makes or breaks it, and that's the most recent remake of Black Christmas.
Oh, okay,
which has some really interesting characters and some really interesting manipulations of the original storyline in order to say something that's kind of relevant now to the way we talk about feminism and sexism today. And I would love to, I think they're a great double feature. I think you watch the new Candyman, watch the new Black Christmas back to back. I think you'll see, I think if you're the kind of person who will appreciate this new Candyman and maybe you missed why some people liked the new Black Christmas, if you watch them back to back, you might realize that, oh, that's what Black Christmas was doing.
Yeah, but Black Christmas is very upfront. It's very openly a very cheap movie. Like you can see the seams in that movie.
Yeah,
like there's a scene where they're doing dialogue and they're clearly shooting from far away and doing like ADR after the fact, and you can see that their mouths aren't moving. Like that kind of like you start noticing little technical stuff like that.
But anyway, the new one, I like the new one.
That's a good idea, though, is that the newest Black Christmas, it's been remade twice. The newest Candyman would play off each other pretty well.
Yeah. All right, well, that's the newest Candyman. Now let's talk about another movie that updates a classic 90s movie. And I don't know if you could hear it in my voice, me putting air quotes on classic there. He's All That, which is a quasi-remake of the 1999 teen comedy She's All That, which starred Freddie Prinze Jr. and Rachel Lee Cook.
And they're all based on George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion.
Yes, which would eventually become the musical My Fair Lady. And basically any story you've ever seen, especially romantic stories, about someone who gives someone else a makeover so that they can either join polite society or become cool or become famous, it's George Bernard Shaw. George Bernard Shaw did this amazing play called Pygmalion. Yeah. It's really, really funny, very acidic. It's been
adapted into film numerous times as Pygmalion, and then also adapted into the musical My Fair Lady.
What do you prefer, the 1930s movie Pygmalion or My Fair Lady with Audrey Hepburn?
Oh, My Fair Lady by far.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. I think the cast is better in the original, but I can totally see it. They're both good.
In the 1930s film, I had no reason to believe that those two were like falling in love.
I never thought they were falling in love in either version.
Oh, okay.
That's my biggest problem with Pygmalion is I never thought they had any meaningful connection.
My Fair Lady, they were just stuck together. My Fair Lady at least has I've grown accustomed to her face. Well, which isn't really
a romantic number.
No, but he's sort of a dry character, but you see what's going on because it's musical and it's Lerner and Lowe and it's great.
I think Leslie Howard gets it across in the 30s one, but anyway.
I do love Leslie Howard, but I don't like his chemistry with the, I forgot who played.
The lead in that one. But we'll think about it later. But anyway, so 1999 comes along, and there was this weird little pocket
of teen movies.
Of teen movies in the late 90s, early 2000s, where all of a sudden, like, the teen genre kind of died off a little bit after the John Hughes boom of the 80s, and there just weren't a lot of them in the 90s. A few notable ones, Can't Hardly Wait, etc. But mostly it wasn't, like, the popular movie genre. A lot of that stuff had moved to television on, like, the WB.
And there were movies about teenage characters all throughout, but there was a very specific type of frothy teenage comedic melodrama. Mm-hmm. That was just gigantic at the time. Yeah. And like starting in 90, Maybe, I don't know, was I it think, I think Romeo plus Juliet, maybe?
I think you can see it starting with Clueless, actually. And that's, oh, I think there Clueless you go, is a noteworthy example here, because what we're talking about largely is the idea of adapting classic literature, in case of Romeo and Juliet classic theater, and setting it in a high school, a contemporary high school setting with contemporary teenagers, in order to, A, capitalize on public domain good drama.
Yeah.
Because
you get a good story, you get good characters, and we update them for a modern audience. Clueless is an adaptation of Jane Austen's Emma.
And it's great.
It's legitimately great. Quite a good film. In addition to Romeo plus Juliet, there were films like 10 Things I Hate About You, which was a modern teen version of The Taming of the Shrew.
Which is quite charming, actually. Yeah. I like that movie a lot.
There was... what was the Twelfth Night remake?
Oh, She's the Man?
She's the Man. I didn't see that one. She's the Man with Amanda Bynes. Remember her.
There was which was a retelling of Othello with, I think it was Mekhi Phifer, Julia Stiles, and Josh Hartnett. Mm. Cruel Intentions was an adaptation of
Dangerous Liaisons.
Dangerous Liaisons. Mm. One of the more popular entries in that was... the Pygmalion adaptation, She's All That, in which Freddie Prinze Jr. plays the most popular dude in school, but his girlfriend just left him for like a MTV celebrity, played by Matthew Lillard, if memory serves. And so he, in order to get his mojo back, accepts a bet from one of his friends that he can take the least popular girl in school and turn her into the most popular girl in school.
Specifically, have her elected prom queen.
Yep. And the least popular girl in school is played by Rachel Lee Cook. There is a movie that does this story better than She's All That called Not Another Teen Movie.
Which is a spoof of all those teen movies.
Of all the, like, scary movie, date movie, superhero movie, of all of those spoofs, Not Another Teen Movie is the one that works best. Because they know what they're making fun of, and they're pretty pointed about it. And there's a lot of parody moments from She's All That, where the dude, played by Chris Evans, is looking at the Rachel Lee Cook character, and he's just like, there's no way I could make her the most popular girl in school. She has a ponytail, and she wears glasses. Yeah. And there's this bit where he takes off the ponytail and the glasses, and he's like, oh my God, she's gorgeous. How did this happen?
The quote, unattractive people are the most attractive people you could possibly imagine.
They're interesting. They're funny. They're very, very attractive. There's this hilarious moment in the original She's All That where Freddie Prinze Jr. takes off Rachel Lee Cook's glasses. And it's like, oh, you're so beautiful. I'm like, you couldn't see that with her glasses on?
She's beautiful with the glasses
also,
on.
Also, I'm going to throw it out there. She doesn't really wear glasses for the rest of the movie. She needs to see. They don't say that she has contacts. They say she's not very well off. She might not be able to afford contacts. I've never had more than one actual working prescription pair of glasses in my whole life. If I had a double, it's from an old prescription. So, yeah, I buy that. They just completely took away her ability to see for fun.
I have not seen the original She's All That. That one passed me by. And
I'm going to say it right now. It's not that great.
I've heard it deals with a lot of like really horrendous sexist tropes, and there's a lot of dated jokes that don't play very well.
It was dated at the time. Oh, I saw it at the time, and I was thinking to myself, I'm a senior in high school. Okay, I'm not exactly wise yet, and I'm watching this, and I'm going, this is some dated sexist bullshit. I think the main cast is charming enough that they get away with it. But it's one of the worst films in that, literary adaptation teen movie cycle, even though it was one of the most successful. So I don't consider it sacred. So if you're going to remake it, I'm like, cool, maybe you'll get it right this time.
Yeah, it was successful enough to warrant a remake 20 years after the fact. Now we have He's All That, which is the exact same story, gender flipped.
Updated a little bit for the modern social media 21st century.
And this is trying to... pander hard at modern teenagers. It's directed by Mark Waters, who did Mean Girls and Vampire Academy, and typically has a pretty good finger on the pulse of how young people are actually funny characters.
Mean Girls and Vampire Academy are both good movies.
Yeah.
Academy is a little like it's setting up too much to be like a good standalone, but it works.
Yeah, it feels a little bit too much like, YA Vampire Wars kind of nonsense, but the interaction between the teen characters is really interesting, and Zoe Deutsch is in it, and she's really great.
Yeah, no, it's an underrated film. It's not a great film.
Yeah, here he is doing He's All That, working with an incredibly small budget. And
Movie looks so cheap.
Yeah.
Like, even for a teen movie where there's not a lot of money you need, it looks very cheap.
There's a scene where the main character is doing karaoke with a beach behind her, and she waves her hand, and her hand passes beyond whatever blue screen she was filming against, and it vanishes in
midair. Oh my god, I didn't even see that. That's hilarious.
It's this little weird technical problem left in the movie.
Of all the times to blink. My god, that's hilarious.
It is literal blink and you miss it. But her hand vanishes in one scene.
That's hilarious.
But the main character is now no longer Freddie Prinze Jr., but played by Addison Rae. Addison Rae is a TikTok star.
Yeah, is that...
I'm too old to know this world. But yeah, she became famous in the world of TikTok. Evidently, she is the world's highest earning TikTok performer.
Oh, good.
And she's a dancer on TikTok.
Well, and now good for her, I guess.
And this has led to her leading this film. She is modern teen version of famous, and that is internet famous. She has she's an influencer. She's made a lot of money as an influencer. Influencer, if you have enough followers, companies will contact you, give you free things, or even money to advertise their products. So she gives like makeup tutorials.
Yeah.
The opening scene is she gets out of bed, showers, brushes her hair, puts on makeup, then gets back in bed, turns on the camera, and pretends like she's just waking up looking like $1 million.
Yep.
You'd think that would be satire, but the film does nothing with this idea.
I don't think it's satire. I think it's just a reality.
Yeah.
And I don't think the movie's making fun of it. I think the movie's just saying this is her job.
When Bo Burnham made the film Eighth Grade, he actually is commenting very heavily on the fact that the person you are under the camera is incredibly different from the person you are in reality.
Yeah.
This film says they're one and the same. And Addison Rae goes about her business talking to her Instagram followers. She's dating a really hot dude who's shirtless and dances around and sings very badly. And she catches him in his trailer with another woman, scandal. She's caught on camera crying and losing it and throwing things at him, justifiably so, I would say.
Yeah, he's cheating on her, and she caught him, and she throws some desserts she made for him at him. And there's a bit where she's like, realizes her best friend is still filming this. This is like going live to her feed. She's so upset that she's got tears and she's got like a snot bubble. And then the snot bubble goes viral, which sounds like the internet.
Well, and it's this weird state of modern fame and, the way, gender disparity of internet infamy, that her snot bubble and her cracking of the vanity is a bigger story than the fact that her boyfriend cheated on her.
He
becomes more famous for this.
Yeah.
And
he
gets more popular for committing an act of infidelity. And she becomes less popular because she had a booger.
Yeah.
And that's not addressed in the movie either.
You really think that would be more of the point, just how completely sexist that is.
So in order to get her Instagram followers back, she decides to take on a project, and the project is the hottest boy in school.
So like the guy that she broke up with was nobody until she gave him like a makeover and helped him out with his like social media presence. So she takes on a challenge from one of her friends to do the exact same thing again.
Yeah.
And it's the same vibe as from She's All That. They go through everyone in the school. They go through like, oh, well, what about that guy, that drug dealer? The crime thing's kind of hot. Yeah. What about this guy?
This computer programmer is like, he's going to be a millionaire next year.
Yeah, every time we cut back to that guy, by the way, I love that he's like this recurring character. He's kind of awesome.
Yeah.
I kind of love that guy.
I liked him and I loved the goth girl. Those were my two favorite characters.
All these little two tiny support characters.
Like they have two lines each, but they
stand out. Yeah. And that's all. I actually think that's good writing. You always want like, even the smallest characters in your movie to have a personality that you can like recognize. That's always worth celebrating, I feel. But then what they end up picking is this guy named Cameron Queller, played by a guy whose name is Tanner Buchanan. And I can't tell which of those names sound more like a CW character.
Memorize Tanner Buchanan, because this guy has young Val Kilmer energy days.
Yeah.
He is unbelievably charming. He has a wonderful screen presence.
I actually like Addison Rae, too. I think they're both quite likable. Yeah.
I feel like Tanner Buchanan, like, is... is spinning gold out of this turd screenplay that he was handed. He is a very good actor, and I think he's a rising star.
He's bringing a lot of genuineness to this. So his whole thing is
he's essentially a kid from 1999.
Kinda. So he lives with his grandmother and his little sister, who also goes to the same college. High school. He's a photographer and he's a critic. Basically, that's what it is. He's not afraid to tell anyone that he thinks things are bullshit. He's barely on social media. He's only tweeted once, and the tweet was no.
Just the word no.
Just very high school. Basically, the whole idea is that he has something akin to principles.
Story of the film.
The idea is that this guy becomes her assignment, and she's going to make him essentially more like everybody else. There's this whole bit where they're going to go... It takes a while for her to, like, make him think that she's, like, really, like, interested in him as a human being and worth hanging out with. Mm-hmm. But when they decide to go to this party, and there's this cute bit where we're going to a Great Gatsby party, and he's like, you know that the parties in Great Gatsby were, like, symbolic of how hopelessly shallow the bourgeois was, right? And she's like, yeah, they don't care. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay. At least we're acknowledging that.
I've seen a lot of versions of this Pygmalion story, or misfits trying to get along.
Mm-hmm.
That's very, very common film trope.
Sure.
And this is a film about trying to bring this artist who understands a lot about the world, who is well-read, who is talented, who works with animals, who loves his grandmother, who dresses like a 90s skater guy, who's insanely attractive...
And make
him into a shallow Instagram star and point out what a great lifestyle that is.
Yeah.
Has it ever happened where the opposite happens, where I'm going to bring you up, I'm going to bring you into my world of opulence and wealth, and you'll have a great time here, and that person ends up discovering art and becoming more interesting and leaving the old world behind?
Prince and the Pauper.
Oh, there you go.
Several different versions. Prince and the Pauper is like two Pygmalions happening at once. There have been a couple of different versions of that where that has happened. I'll give you that. But granted, it should happen more often. But there's this makeover scene where we're going to give him a haircut, and I'll grant you, his facial hair needed to be dealt with. He's a teenager. That needed to be cleaned up.
If you're in high school and you have facial hair, take a good look at it.
And wait.
Some of you can.
Most of you can't.
Most of you.
I couldn't.
I tried.
Oh, yeah. Me too. Bad idea.
I had those long, greasy hair, four greasy hairs coming out of my chin that were 4 inches long apiece. And
bad idea.
That was a beard. No.
Bad idea. Always a bad idea.
Shave it. Stay clean shaven.
Wait until you can grow something out thicker. You'll be happier for it, I promise you. But in any case, at the end of this montage, and they just show him and he, like, walks out. And, like, there's a big reveal thing and she's all that. Where, she looks just like everyone else now. Huzzah. I'm like, great. He comes out and he looks just like everyone else. He looks really generic.
Mm.
Even every single thing about this character that they had very carefully crafted so that he stood out from other people and had a personality and had interests and all of this gone.
Mm.
And I just wanted to throw things at my TV.
I'm not really sure. I think this film has really twisted values. I think at the end of the day, it is not trying to find a middle ground between the vain influencer and the artistic student. I think it's just trying to say that the vain influencer has a soul and is worth saving, and in fact, we need to go into that world. This is where teenagers live now, and we need to be comfortable with that and celebrate that. The Addison Rae character isn't a great human being.
Well, she's also not awful either, and I think that's worth noting here. The only thing she does in this movie...
She doesn't do bad things.
The worst thing she does is he's a little.
But she's not an interesting person.
Well, I disagree with that, and I'll say this right now. I don't think this is a great movie. I think this is not getting a C+ for me. But I also, there are things that I kind of dug about it, and one of the things that I liked about it was that this didn't feel like a movie where one character was bad and one character was good. In fact, they were both being a little judgy, but the idea that Addison Rae's character isn't shallow and vacuous and rich. She's actually working class, pretending to be rich for the sake of her followers. Is a job.
That's true.
And that's the deal here. What we're talking about here isn't influencer just for popularity's sake. She's an influencer because she has discovered that she's good at it. Mm. And this is her high school job. One of the first things we see in the movie, after she wakes up, puts on all the fakery, pretends she just woke up, does an AMA, and then goes to school, is she talks to her mom, played by Rachel Lee Cook, not playing the same character from She's All That.
Could have. I don't know why not.
That's not what she wanted to be, so it would have been kind of a sad story if she never got to be a great painter. But anyway.
She was a painter.
Yeah. Well, but whatever.
Just write it that way. She's a painter now.
Yeah. You could have done that. They chose not to. Whatever. Anyway. She talks to her mom. She's very supportive of her mom. And her mom even just says, hey, who paid the plumbing bill? And she was like, I paid the plumbing bill. You work really, really hard for us. I'm making money. And I'm like, okay, so here's someone who isn't... It almost would have been cleaner if she was vacuous. But she's not. She's actually just, this is something she's good at. This is... Okay. Influencer is an occupation in and of itself and doesn't have to be... positive or negative, although it has positive or negative qualities. And I think this is actually an interesting film in that it looks at the idea of an influencer, of someone who uses social media to market themselves and then make money. And she's saying she's doing it for college. She's not doing it because she wants like a newer car. She's doing it to set up a good future for herself. And the idea that this is just the reality of the world in which we live, and here's someone who is doing it to make money, and they're good at it, and they're not being hopelessly immoral about it. Mm. It's not like she's, like, hawking cigarettes or anything like that, or that she's being cruel and doing a bunch of mean girl shit. She's giving beauty advice.
Yeah.
And, yeah, she's selling makeup products in the process, but a lot of people do that. I can only be so mad about that. It's not great, but it's not also evil. And so I thought that was kind of interesting that a movie has this neutral attitude about that rather than a judgmental, the adults who made this movie do not approve approach.
I suppose so. And then that would have been also a way to condescend. But I wish they had played into the financial aspect a little bit more.
Agreed.
That this is her job, because she's really excited about this. This is not depicted as her job. It's depicted as sort of her life. This is how she lives. This is how she thinks. And if she weren't on Instagram, she would still be living this way. Mm-hmm. That was the impression I got. And if there was a moment where she said, this is my job and it's exhausting. I do this all the time.
That would have been nice.
And, you know, you think there isn't a day where I wish I didn't have to get up at, you know, and put makeup on before I, quote, wake up. That would have been great. That'd be a good vacation for me. There's no moment like that in this movie.
It would be good if they both had a moment like that. Yeah. And even Tanner Buchanan had said, listen, being this outsider artist and not being part of what is popular is also exhausting. And sometimes it would be great to just be able to go with the flow and not feel like I would be losing my identity in the process.
Yeah.
And to like be okay just going to a party or going to prom. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to enjoy that too a little bit? You could have done that, and that would have made the movie a lot stronger. And I feel like there's a lot of opportunities this movie misses to be a little more genuine about what it is like. Because listen, there's this great bit in 21 Jump Street where Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum go back to high school, and high school in just like 8 years has changed so much they don't recognize it anymore.
Yeah, in fact, the whole social hierarchy, the cliched ones that you've seen in every movie,
the jocks rule everything,
and they pick on nerds has now been completely reversed.
Yeah.
And that's very good for Jonah Hill, who was a nerd and still is.
But anyway, I think about that's a great joke, but it's also true. It's like in the movie Mimic, you know, where like, okay, we release this cockroach into the wild and then it's evolved into like human size. But how can they do that? It's only been a few years. You can't think about years. You got to think about generations, cultural generations, especially amongst teenagers who really absorb everything new. That moves very rapidly.
Yeah.
And if I somehow wound up, I don't know, if I taught a high school class or something like that, or if like one day your son will go to high school and you'll have to like see what it's like in high school, it's probably going to be weird. It's probably going to be almost completely unrecognizable on some level. It's going to be really off-putting. I find this kind of movie where I don't know how accurate this is, but where they're trying to say that like, here's how different high school is. I find that kind of interesting, actually.
Yeah.
But there's also something just really simple about it, which is that no one in high school knows fucking anything. They're all just trying to find their personalities and assert themselves and find a way to survive inside this really prison-like environment where you're stuck there whether you like it or not, and you better find a click fast or it gets harder and harder. Like, all of that's kind of universal.
I guess. It's not something I ever experienced.
Really?
I've never seen my school experiences...
Well, not directly.
Accurately represented in film.
But you've never seen, like, in just a general sort of way?
Not once.
Wow. Okay.
American History X came close, and that's only because they filmed at my high school.
Okay, I was about to say, there's a lot of fucked up shit in American History X. I don't know why that's the one you'd go... Okay.
No.
Angus filmed at my... Well, that was in middle school, actually. Did any movie film at my high school?
Well, I went to Venice High School, which was also the setting for Rydell High in Greece.
Okay.
And that was sort of its big claim to fame.
Quite a few movies shot at my middle school. I don't recall if any movies shot at my high school. I don't think so. Mm. Weird.
And Venice High School has that big statue of Myrna Loy out front.
Oh, yeah.
Which she paid for herself.
Good for her.
Yeah, she was a graduate of Venice High. Yeah. This is sort of movie version of high school. There's not a lot of interesting ideas in here.
Yeah.
Even though we've been talking about it for a while, I think the characters are not very well drawn out, and I think it values strange things. There are a few cute moments, but ultimately, this is just vapid trash.
What I appreciate about this movie, and I think it's what I appreciate about the original She Is All That too, is that the material isn't great. I think the material is arguably a little better in this one than the original, but that still leaves a lot of room to not be great. Mm. But what I see here is actually like some interesting cast members who I feel like we could see like later on. Mm. We could look back and go like, oh, wow, they all got their start in like He's All That.
Yeah.
You know, because like, again, Tanner Buchanan's quite good.
Tanner Buchanan, yeah.
Let's see. What's the name of Tanner Buchanan's like best friend? Annie Jacob. Mm. She's very interesting. I really like her in the film as well. Who plays his sister?
Oh, she was really good. The younger sister character.
Yeah, Tanner Buchanan has a younger sister. I'm trying to look it up. Isabella Crivetti plays his younger sister. She's very good in this movie, and I like her quite a bit. There's this one weird bit at the end.
She's an actual teenager, and she plays an actual teen, which is nice because most of the other actors are very clearly in their mid-20s.
I think she's actually one of the better actors in the movie, and there's this really emotional moment at the end where she, like, confronts her brother about, like, all the changes he's been going through and how she kind of misses the side of him that was able to have fun ever since their mom died. And it's this interesting moment because they're clearly trying to be, like, really bring it down a notch instead of being all this, like, superficial teen crap. It's supposed to be, like, kind of genuine teen crap. And she, in that scene, is at a 10. And I'm pretty sure they asked for a 7.
Yeah.
She's really giving this movie way more than this movie is asking for. And probably needs, honestly, because it's a little much. But you can tell that this is her, like, really, really trying to get something out of this very thin character. And good for her. I bet. I hope we see good things from her later. Because, again, there's a lot of talented young people here. The movie itself, but their next two films I actually haven't seen.
Okay.
So why don't you just start taking point on this, and why don't we go from one comedy to another? Tell me about Vacation Friends.
Vacation Friends. It's the latest film. It's on Hulu.
Ooh, I'm going to love this review. This is going to be like reading the works of Pauline Kael.
Lil Howery and Yvonne Orgie play a couple who have gone to Mexico. It turns out he was going to propose, and even though the room didn't work out, there was a flooding in their hotel, he ends up popping the question right there in the lobby, and she says yes, they're engaged, hooray. This attracts the attention of two other vacationing Americans, played by John Cena and Meredith Hagner, and they're the party couple. They invite, it's like, you know what, we were able to get this special deal, we have this gigantic suite, stay in our room with us, and we're great, and here, have a cocktail, welcome to our room. Wow, this salt isn't very salty. Oh, it's cocaine. We're giving you cocaine. It's like, didn't we see you early doing, like, really, like, smoking weed while on a jet ski? Yeah, that was us. It's like, we're gonna rent a boat? Yeah, let's rent a boat and crash it. Like, it's really crazy. They spend the entire week together, and they celebrate their entire week together with an orgy. And
All four of them.
All four of them.
Wow.
It's filmed in a very obfuscated way, so...
No, still, it's a plot point a lot of movies wouldn't go for.
I wish they were a little bit more explicit about it, because it turns out it's told, like, the Lil Howery character like he's so out of it, like he's so drunk that he's only like vaguely perceiving things. In plain English, they had an orgy, although it's so vague, you could say, oh, they just had a wild night of some kind. The Lil Rel character is the neurotic character, and the John Cena character is the free spirit, and they're going to, at first, they're going to sort of bond over the fact, but when it comes time to actually have the wedding months later, and John Cena and his girlfriend shows up very, very pregnant, he's going to upset the square family that Lil Rel Howery is trying to impress. There is not a single original idea in any of this.
I was thinking about like the orgy is kind of unusual.
Although that was also kind of a part of Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar earlier this year.
Oh, I actually didn't see Barb and Star yet.
A vastly superior comedy.
And now that I know there's an orgy in it.
It's implied that there's a threesome in that movie.
Okay.
And they just have it. It's like, cool. It's not even a big deal. The parentage of the unborn baby is the central plot for the rest of the movie, but
oh, okay.
Then yeah, we're going to go on a golfing expedition and John Cena does wacky stuff and they end up taking drugs and, but he ends up using his free spirit to, make some things better for him. Look, I don't care about this movie. I don't care.
What makes this movie go from it's not good to I just don't want to talk about it? Tell me about that decision.
There's a type of neurotic movie character that doesn't resemble any kind of real life neurosis. The kind of uptight, schedule driven male. They're typically a male character.
Right.
And they're told to sort of loosen up by free spirit. Usually that involves drugs. If you take drugs or if you get drunk or you just go a little wild, you'll loosen up and you'll be a better person for it. It's so unbelievably artificial, these types of characters. And watching otherwise talented comedians try to mine comedy out of these cliched human avatars is such a tiresome experience. Because they're not looking for the humanity in the character. They're not trying to act the character, and they're not looking for something that actually needs to be addressed in terms of their neurosis.
Right.
It's a neurosis as an affect.
Okay.
And it's free-spiritedness as an affect. These don't ever come across as real human beings who have different ways of living.
What is the difference? Okay, let me ask you this then. And again, I didn't see this movie. I'm not defending the movie. I'm talking about strictly the tone. What is the difference between something like what this movie is doing and, say, the screwball comedies of the 30s, where everything was exceptionally arch as well, and most of the characters had little in common with an actual human being, someone like, say, Bringing Up Baby?
Okay.
What is this movie failing to capture that the success of those movies or the longevity of those movies? Why do those movies work, arguably?
They know how to play that kind of artificiality for actual humor.
Mm-hmm.
The older films were very heavily scripted and very story and dialogue driven, whereas these more recent comedies tend to be a little bit more laid back and actor driven, and they let a lot more they let the character types do the heavy lifting rather than the sharp dialogue and the sharp performances.
They don't feel guided
by a cohesive vision. They feel really loose and many cases, not in the case of Vacation Friends, but in many cases they let the comedian actors do a lot of sort of riffing and improvising.
I feel like we're starting to move away from that finally.
Luckily, yes. Yeah. That's not a big part of this movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, you look at a movie like, from the 1930s, which is 70 minutes long and only needs to be 70 minutes long and gets a lot of mileage out of good dialogue and actually more interesting character types.
Yeah.
They're actually putting a little bit of variety, a little bit of spin. And also they understand that they're drawing from old comedy tradition. So there is actually kind of a classical feel to a lot of those older movies, not because they're old, but because they're drawing on older traditions.
So what you're saying is, at the end of the day, Vacation Friends stinks.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. We can move on.
That's I could have just said that.
Yeah, but we have to
do my critical due diligence to, and describe exactly
why that's a thing. All right, well, what about No Man of God? Is that a Laugh Riot?
Well, how do you feel about Ted Bundy? This is a Ted Bundy movie. And there are a lot of Ted Bundy movies. Ted Bundy has been the subject of a lot of, and I've seen a lot of Ted Bundy movies, going all the way back to The Deliberate Stranger with Mark Harmon and the TV miniseries. With young Terry Farrell, and M. Emmett Walsh plays the cop in that one.
Mm. And weirdly enough, I've actually seen relatively... I've seen a lot of Dahmer-related movies. I actually haven't seen a lot of Bundy-related movies, even though I know there's a million of them.
Yeah.
I don't know why. They never seem to come up. I never was like, hey, we need to watch this Ted Bundy movie. I don't know.
I've seen...
Never comes up.
I've seen numerous Ted Bundy movies. Ted Bundy was an infamous serial killer who I think confessed to... He was sentenced to death for sexual assault and for murder. And I think he ended up... I think they were able to connect him to somewhere around 30 deaths?
30 confessed, 20 confirmed.
Okay, 20 confirmed. He confessed to 30. There are some theories that he might have been responsible for the deaths of hundreds of women. And he had a very particular MO. Matthew Bright, who did the film Freeway, so good sleazy filmmaker, did an incredibly sleazy movie about Ted Bundy called simply Ted Bundy in 2002. It's not factually accurate, but I feel like that film really got under the skin of just what an animal he was. Just how disconnected he was from the rest of humanity appetites.
Let's not be cruel to animals by bringing them into this.
Ted
Bundy is a monster. Okay.
This is a two-hander. It feels like a stage play in a lot of ways between Ted Bundy, who in this movie is played by an actor named Luke Kirby, and Bill Hagmeier, the FBI agent, played by Elijah Wood, who was assigned to psychologically profile Ted Bundy in the early days of what become the common practice of psychologically profiling criminals.
Right.
Wasn't really common yet. They had to start interviewing criminals, get into their mindset, understand the criminal a little bit better so you could become a better
profiler.
And this is about the series of interviews they had together, which took place over the course of several years, where Bill Hagmeier would visit Ted Bundy, Bill and Ted, he would visit him in prison, and they would just sort of eventually, in this very strange way, learn to regard each other as human and become friends in a way. Bill Hagmeier really understood Ted Bundy. Ted Bundy blows Bill Hagmeier's... Bill Hagmeier's like kind of this nerdy guy. He's a stuffed shirt. He's a suit. He's looking for something very clear-cut about what's aberrant about you, Ted Bundy. What drives you to do these things?
We think there's just going to be like one clear thing, and then we can just look out for that thing, and we can outlaw that thing.
That might be why we keep coming back to Ted Bundy, because we see him as this like fascinating aberration. And the thesis of this movie that Ted Bundy says is... No ordinary people do this. I'm just the one who ends up doing it, but anybody could kill. Mm-hmm. Anybody has my appetites. Do you think the fact that I had a lot of Playboy magazines, which they tried to sort of say that's like indicative of my depravity, and that's what led to my killing. Do you think having a lot of Playboys led to my killing? No, Playboys
everywhere.
I just like those.
Yeah.
And I just like killing, and that's just an ordinary thing for me. And this is something Bill Hagmeier has a lot of trouble swallowing, but he ends up living with it to the point where he starts like breaking down a little bit. And there's this really chilling sequence where he's driving down the street looking at people, and you can see him like he's actually like weighing that in his mind. By the end of the film, it ends up being about the final days of Ted Bundy's life and how they're trying to get confessions out of him and a stay of execution. He has ended up being put to death by the state. I think when it comes to the actual like catharsis and the crux of the plot and the things that actually make it a movie, it kind of flounders. It's like Candyman in that regard, where the actual like plotting and structure don't really hold up very well. But I feel like there's a pretty good conversation being had between these two characters for a long portion of it, and I think it's
so the performances are bringing it up.
The performances and some of the ideas that we're using Ted Bundy as we're essentially using the media's fascination with Ted Bundy as a way to not explain Ted Bundy or sociopathy, but kind of demystify him in a way where we're not trying to treat him like this sort of mythic figure.
Fascinating individual. He's just some dude who killed a lot of people.
Yeah, he's just some dude who killed a lot of people. And I think that's what the conversation, like when they're smiling and kind of joking around with each other, it's just a dude.
Yeah.
And it's not trying to humanize him, but I mean, that is what it's doing, but it's not trying to get us to feel sympathy for him. It's trying to get us to understand that these kinds of dark impulses are a lot more common than we think they might be.
Okay, so that's interesting.
Which
and I think the idea of demystifying serial killers is probably very healthy if done correctly. So, but in the end,
In the end, it's pretty good. I do like the, but I think this would play a lot better as a play, where we actually get to see the action rise and fall with the two actors on stage the entire time.
That could be cool.
With you know the filmic techniques where you know with all the editing and you know it takes place over several years, I think kind of has us drawing back a little bit and pushing us forward a little bit too much. Whereas we should probably just be in there with them, like kind of locked into that room with these two men.
Okay. Well, on the critically acclaimed scale, that is how we review movies. At the end of every episode, we review the new releases on a scale of C- to C+. C is an average, you know, a little bit of good, a little bit of bad. C+ is above average. We genuinely recommend this movie, whether we simply like it or love it. And C- is below average. We don't think it's particularly good. We might even hate its guts. On the critically acclaimed scale, how is No Man of God?
No Man of God. It's a B. B. It's a B.
Wow.
It's not a B. It's a C.
Okay.
A C.
Okay.
Welcome back to the B Movies Podcast.
Oh, no.
That was our old rating scale. It's a C. It's aiming really high. It doesn't quite hit, but I think there's just enough interesting stuff to, you know, make it interesting.
All right. What about Vacation Friends?
Go away. Go away, Vacation Friends.
You need to say it out loud.
That's true. It's a C minus. Very clearly, it's a C minus.
Someone recently wrote in that they were cataloging all of our ratings, and if we don't actually say it out loud, they don't count. So we have to make sure we actually say the words. He's All That.
Also a C minus.
Okay.
I think it's. I think some of the young cast is very charming, but that this is a very trite film that is not really amusing or funny or moving in any kind of meaningful way.
Fair enough. I'm actually going to give it a C. Not a passionate C. I think the cast elevates it a little. I think there is something that it is doing about treating elements of what is normal for high school students as actually normal. Instead of the way a lot of other Hollywood movies do, which is their parents are confused and the parents are making the movie. And rather than wait 10 years for like people to actually start making movies who grew up with this, let's just do it now.
Yeah. And Mark Waters is the director to do that kind of thing.
Sure,
he's done it so many times before.
For me, it's hindered by a certain lack of thematic clarity, and also it's way too cheap. Mm. Like, it's cheap. It looks like a straight to video sequel, which is unfortunate. And then lastly, Candyman, which I give a big old C+.
I give it a C+. I also give it a C+. It's a little bit qualified because I do think there's a lot that it kind of bungles here and there, but it's not enough to detract from a lot of the interesting ideas that do come across pretty clearly.
Anything that the movie doesn't quite get right, or anything that feels a little rushed, or whatever, it's because they were trying to fill the movie with interesting ideas and scary scenes, and it's not because they weren't trying hard enough. I think ultimately that makes the movie feel really dense and rich, and even if parts of it don't quite work, all the other parts make up for it.
I feel like that can be mishandled, having so many ideas that your film just falls apart, and I feel that way about Us. So all of the sloppiness I blame on... specifically on Jordan Peele, one of the screenwriters.
Yeah.
Just because it resembles Us in many ways.
Mm-hmm. I would not be shocked if that was the case.
But I don't like Us. I think that just splays everywhere.
I like Us a lot, but I agree. It's the worst part of Us is it's sort of its lack of clarity. Mm-hmm. And I think This one suffers from that too, but I do think it comes together well enough at the end that it gets away.
It comes together far better than Us, and in a way that I can wholeheartedly.
I think the ending of this one works better than the ending of Us, but that's a Jordan Peele movie, and this is a Nikki DaCosta movie, and good for them.
Nia DaCosta.
What did I say?
You said Nikki.
Motherfucker.
It's all right.
Okay.
Little slip of the tongue.
Apologies. Anyway, that is it for Critically Acclaimed. Thank you everybody for listening. We think you're great. If you want to get more Critically Acclaimed, it's pretty easy to do. You can head over to patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, and we have a lot of exclusive shows at a variety of different tiers. You can also vote for future episodes of Critically Reclaimed. You get online hangouts at certain tiers. We have shows about Batman, Star Trek, the Academy Awards. We do commentary tracks. All of that is available at our Patreon page, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We're also on social media at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
We also have an email podcast called We've Got Mail, where every week we answer emails or letters from our various listeners. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net if you want to talk about anything we discussed on this episode or anything else that's on your mind. We also have a P.O. box for people who like to send us actual physical letters. We got a couple more of those this week.
Hooray.
Whitney, what is the P.O. box?
Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
We also have me and my partner, M. Lampas da Silva. We have an online soap store where we make handcrafted soaps. That is over on Etsy. You can follow us on social media, Salt Cat Soap, all one word, Salt Cat Soap. We have links to the Etsy store from there. Just search for Salt Cat Soap on Etsy. We have soaps, lotions, bath salts, stickers of our cat, Luca. All of it's available there. And if you order right now, we're actually giving out coupons that you can then stack, and you can get as much as 20% off on our Labor Day sale, which is coming up in about a week. Mm-hmm. So head on over. Check it out. What do you tell them about your other podcast?
Oh, that's right. Over on The Screen's Margins, which is a podcasting network run by the venerable B. Peterson, they and I talk about Ovid on a podcast called All About Ovid, spelled with all O's. If you know how to spell it, you'll find it.
And if not, good luck.
And if not, it's not a Googleable title, which is the best kind of title. They and I talk about a lot of the wonderfully esoteric selection over on Ovid, the streaming service, which is a lot of deep cut art house stuff. It's international cinema. It's the stuff that played at museums. On our last episode, we talked about filmmaker Yang Mingming. We've talked about Patricio Guzman. We talked about Marlon Riggs. We've talked about a lot of Lav Diaz. We even had an episode where we went over and talked with Dave White about Tsai Ming Liang. So a lot of really interesting international cinema, a lot of really exciting art that's put up on that streaming service. And we watch whatever we can and talk about whatever we caught that week.
Nice. All right. Well, anyway, thank you everybody for listening. And we'll be back later this week with more podcasts and next week with more Critically Acclaimed. And I'm tired. So goodbye, everybody. Never forget, everyone's a critic.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?
A new year, time for new growth. Grow your education and skills with Herzing University. Our online behavioral health programs fit your schedule and time. From an 8-month diploma program in health and human services to a 36-month bachelor's in psychology. Grow your behavioral health career with us wherever you are in your education. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Visit us online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109. Online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109.